left off talking about the four fundamental questions, and the first question is there more than a physical world? And answering that question will lead to, well, all right, is there a God? I was in a debate with a philosopher there at the University of Arkansas. We had a packed auditorium, and the students were spilling out into the foyer and the hallways. And during our debate, he was challenging, of course, well, he was arguing in the case that there is no God. But one of the things that he pointed out was the law of thermodynamics does not doesn't actually say that something can come from nothing. That was a lie, number one. The second thing that happened was during the Q&A session, a student got up. Actually, it wasn't a student. It was an alumnus, but he was part of the Free Thinkers Atheist Association in Fayetteville, and they were all there as well and asked me a question. Well, he asked me the question because during the Q&A sessions, I'd been making the case for God. God, there is good, hardcore evidence that there must be a God. A reasonable person is going to draw that conclusion. So this person got up and said, well, you haven't given an argument about which God. Of course not. That's not the debate. It was, is there a God? But I point out, thank you for bringing that up because that's the next step. You see, when they lose the debate, then they're going to move the goal. You know what that means. I mean, if you're in a debate and you're challenging each other and your opponent begins to realize, well, they don't have answers or they're losing ground, then they move the goal on you. So now you have to hit another point, and they keep moving it around. So actually the conversation goes nowhere. Eventually it goes around in circles, and you're not making any headway. I'm going to show you how to really make a good, clear case for God. And if you make a good, clear case for God, then you answered question number one, is there more than a physical world? And a lot of people wonder, can you even make that case with science? Yes, you can. And one of the reasons why they don't think that you can actually do that, make the case for God from the physical world, is because they believe that the physical world can only test that which is physical. Do you agree with that? I have to think about that one. Well, that's true. You can only test. I mean, how are you going to test something that's not physical? So it's true. But here's how science works. It is not about proving something. You'll never hear a scientist say, we have proven. You'll hear lay people say, we have proven, or science has proven. But a scientist never says, we have proven something. Now, the only time that you will hear, and I have to qualify the statement, the only thing that science actually can prove is what can't be. All right, think about that. It's always working the negative. I can't show you, I can't prove you to you that my theory is correct. However, I can show you that everything we thought of up to this point has not proven it wrong. And if I've exhausted every avenue and every condition I can think of to prove it wrong and I can't, I might be right. This is how science works. It's working on the proving wrong, not the proving right. And that's why you can't say you've actually proven anything. And so it doesn't matter, for example, if you have 10,000 reasons why you might be right, if I've got one reason why you're wrong, it dispels everything. That means your 10,000 reasons are wrong interpretations, is what it means. So you have to go back to the drawing board and come up with a better interpretation for all those evidences. So you see, those positive evidences are important, but they're not evidence that support your theory. It's what you're looking for to disprove that establishes the credibility of your science. Now, again, I'm not going to go through a science lesson with you, but one more qualifying statement. Part of the confirmation that the theory might be correct is predictability. So if it's right, I should be able to apply it and see something positive or supportive happening, and that's prediction. And so that's an important part of scientific modeling as well. All right, now, so much for that little philosophy of science, and maybe that'll be helpful to some of you. All right, now, answering the questions, four fundamental questions, is going to take us to the correct worldview. And so what we want to do is answer question number two, and if we get number to question two, well, that pretty well sums up question number one as well. Now, one of the things we have to deal with is the question of faith and science. Faith provides spiritual evidence. As I mentioned a little earlier in the previous lesson, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, and let's just turn over there just to look at it real quick. And I do talk about this quite a bit and often because it's so important. I think one of the weak spots in the Christian faith is the notion of blind faith. That is a humanistic faith. The humanists have pretty well cornered the market on what faith is. But, of course, faith is blind to a humanist. They don't know God. They've rejected God. They don't understand faith. And when a Christian says, by faith we believe, what they hear is by blind faith. By that which I have no clue about, I just believe it. That's how they define faith because they have no experience with a seeing faith. That's their problem. For Christians, we should be able to go to Hebrews 11:1 and understand that when it says, now faith is the substance. See, that's putting some meat to it, isn't it? It's not blindness. It's not vain. It's not empty. There's something to it. Substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God so that things which are not are seen were not made of things which do appear. So when we talk about faith and science, we're talking about evidence. Not non-evidence and evidence. We're talking about spiritual evidence and physical evidence. I hope that's a different way for you to think. That when we talk about faith, we're talking about substance. We're talking about something that's real. We're talking about confirmation. When the Holy Spirit of God comes and imparts a measure of faith to you, which comes by the hearing of the Word of God and faith by hearing, what that means is God is giving you the confirmation of the truth, the evidence of what you just heard in the gospel message. God is personalizing his message in your heart. That's what I meant by saying last night. Faith personalizes the acceptance or rejection of God's message between you and God himself. We are merely messengers. But then God takes that message as it goes into our minds. He takes that message and confirms it with faith. He confirms it with evidence. He confirms it with substantial evidence. Let's say making that which is otherwise intangible, tangible to us within. And you know what we call that experience? Conviction. And that's a very real thing. We experience conviction, a very real experience. Why? God has confirmed a truth by faith within us, and we know the evidence, the confirmation that that is true. So this is how God confirms things by faith. It's a seeing faith. It's a real faith. It's an evidential faith. Science, on the other hand, is going to provide physical evidence rather than spiritual evidence. So God provides the spiritual evidence. Then we can investigate the physical world, and we have the physical evidence. And just to take that a little further for you, to extend the thought, the spiritual and physical worlds are not two different worlds. They're the same world. Think about it. You see, the physical world is the spiritual world that we are able to detect with our senses. And we call it physical. But they both are one and the same world. It's not two different worlds. In a series of another set of lessons, I talk about which maybe we shouldn't call them two different worlds, physical world, spiritual world. We ought to call them dimensions. The spiritual dimension and the physical dimension of the same world. Because they are the same world. And then when we have that understanding, we're realizing that the spiritual world refers to that part of reality in our world that is beyond our senses. Even our senses of magnetism, you cannot detect the magnetic fields around you. But we can see the effects on iron filings or with magnets around. We can see it and demonstrate it. But otherwise, we're totally oblivious to it because we don't have the magnetic eyes to see it with, or the magnetic ears to hear it with, or the magnetic sense of touch to touch it. We don't know it's there. So there's a lot in our world. There's more to our world that we are not able to detect with our senses than we are. And it's only with the equipment and the technology that we've developed that we've been able to expand, extend, and go beyond our senses to detect even the electromagnetic spectrum. And so what we see with our eyes makes up about that much of the electromagnetic spectrum, and the rest of it just continues out in infinity. Where does it stop? We haven't found the end. But we call it microwave or radio frequencies. We have AM and FM radio frequencies. We have the electromagnetic radiation that continues, gamma radiation. It just keeps going. But we only see that much. Why do we know that there's more? Because we developed technology to detect it. So that which was otherwise spiritual and undetectable is now physical. That's why I say a good definition for the spiritual is that part of the world we are not able to detect yet. But it's one of the same. And you can see that in the Bible when you see Elijah praying that his servant that God would open up his eyes so he could see the chariots there to defend Elijah, right? Were they in a different world? No, they were there. They were there the whole time. But you see, the servant didn't know that. And so we are in the midst of a spiritual world right now. There's a spiritual warfare going on. We're engaged in it. We are participants in it, but we don't see it. And by and large, we're unaware of it. And if we're not in the Word of God in prayer, then we're totally oblivious to it. But we're not victimless. We are victims of the spiritual warfare going on. So there's a lot to our world that's going on right now that we call spiritual. So science provides the physical evidence, whereby faith provides the spiritual evidence. And when I use the word empirical, I'm talking about the word that refers to the physical. That which I can taste, touch, feel, smell, I can put on the balance, the weighing balance, or I can measure the force or whatever it might be. Measurement is what science is all about. So when we talk about empirical evidence, we're talking about the physical world, the physical evidence. We can actually determine and argue the case for God, in spite of the fact that the atheist said you can't argue for God with empirical evidence because you can't put God in the test tube. We don't have to put God in a test tube. What we're going to do is rule out what it can't be, and we're going to come up with a conclusion. Well, it must be God. See what we're going to do? And that's how science works. Now, laws of science are the best evidence that there is. And so I'm to demonstrate empirically or with physical evidence to demonstrate the existence of God or more than a physical world, we're going to go for the best evidence, not hypothesis, not theories. We're going to go for the laws of science. And where do laws of science come from? Well, as you see, there's three exercises within the scientific method that derive theories or support hypotheses. And that is observation, interpretation, and experimentation. We observe our world around us and we take measurements. And science is all about numbers. I have to take a measurement. I even have to determine what color the glass is on here. In fact, it's exactly what's going on in a computer screen. You look at the TV screen or the computer screen, what's going on there? There is a computer program going on, mathematically calculating what shade of red, blue, green, and so on is in there. So there is a number value associated with every color. And ultimately, it goes right down to the frequency of the light wave itself. So you can actually spell out with a number the color, the light wave you're actually talking about. Why did I tell you that? To point out that math ultimately is the language of science, because science is all about measurement. Measurement is all about numbers, and numbers, hey, that's math. And so math is the language of science, and that's what we're dealing with here. You observe, you collect your numbers, you collect your information. Now you have to interpret it. That's the second step in the scientific method. So now I interpret my observation and why I explain what I just saw, and then I have to test my hypothesis to see if I can repeat it, if I can demonstrate that that interpretation is correct. Now, if I prove it wrong, then I'm wrong. Then I have to go back to the drawing board, and that results in more observation, which means another interpretation, which means another experiment, which leads to more observation, interpretation, experimentation. It keeps going and going and going and going. And one of the things I think makes, and personally find, science very exciting, because there's no end to it. You just keep going around and around in circles. It's like a rat in a cage. All right. So the scientific laws, what happens here is laws of science are derived from hypotheses, and it's the interpretation step. That first of all, I propose a hypothesis, and then I go to the laboratory and I test my idea and I try to prove it wrong. And I think of every possible combination of variables that I can to try and prove it wrong. I can't. Hey, this thing might be right. So now after I run the experiment one more time just to make sure, because I'm about to publish this, and my peers are going to what? Well, they're going to try and prove me wrong. Why? Because that's how science works. They're not trying to be mean. They're just trying to prove me wrong, prove the theory wrong. And so I'm going to publish this, and now everyone in that field is going to jump on it and try to prove it wrong. Oh, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? That's why you go that one extra experiment, just to make sure you thought it all, because you don't want some peer in your field saying, well, did you think of this? Oh, man, what an idiot. Okay. You don't want to come out that way. So you do your best to try to prove yourself wrong. Well, then your peers, they go out, try and prove you wrong. If they can't prove you wrong over and over and over again, now your hypothesis becomes a theory. That's the difference between a hypothesis and a theory, between you and what your peers have done. Now, after repeated experiments over and over and over again, never showing you wrong, it looks like it's got very good accurate predictions 100% of the time, it becomes a law. That's where the laws of science come from. Now, that's hardcore. That's the closest thing we can get to with proof, and that's why I'm telling you, that's why we want to go to the laws of science. So, laws of science are empirically derived. It's the closest thing you're going to get to when you come to actual, it's not proof, but it's the closest thing you're going to get to proof. All science models, all good science models conform to the laws of science. You do not have a credible, legitimate, rational explanation if it contradicts a law of science. Mark that down, because that's where you're going to nail the evolutionists right there. You have to having a theory and having evidence to support your theory is not good enough. You have to have a theory that does not contradict a law. All right? So, is there a God? Well, the Bible says yes. That's the biblical worldview. The humanistic worldview says no. Well, all worldviews with the wrong answer are going to be wrong. So how do we determine right and wrong then? Well, we're going to go into the lab and we're going to see if we can discover the truth of it all. Now, there are two laws that we're going to look at for the origin of the universe and one law for the origin of life. So there's three laws of science that we're going to look at this afternoon. The first law of thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics, and the law of biogenesis. How many are phasing out? Nobody. Great. Okay, well, let's move forward then. The first law of thermodynamics, I'm telling you, this is hardcore stuff. When we get done, I want you to be able to say, I can use this. I can share this. Okay, that's the goal. And my goal is not just to talk to you. My goal is to pass it on to you so you can use it. All right, the first law of thermodynamics, when you talk to an atheist or someone who's doubting or maybe a son or a daughter or a grandchild, I want you to be able to tell them what the first law of thermodynamics is, like thermos, dynamic, personality, thermos, thermodynamic. You can say it. Thermodynamics. First law of thermodynamics is energy cannot be created by natural means. Now, I'll just tell you a funny story about that because there's some philosophers, the Fayetteville free thinkers, boy, they really get, they hate me. They write nasty things about me, say nasty things about me. I call them the Dirty Dozen. Whenever I'm speaking in Fayetteville, they're always there to heckle and chase the crowds away. They're just mean, hateful spirited people. But this gets under, I mean, this gets under their skin. So this is what you ought to say if you want to get them riled up. Energy cannot be created by natural means. You won't find that anywhere in a book. You can't say that. I had, during one meeting, lecture, I had this up on the board. Energy cannot be created by natural means. And the president of their group said, you can't say that. There's no book that says that. And I point out, number one, that's true. There is no official definition of the first law of thermodynamics. It's described. It's described. So number two, tell me what part of this is wrong. That's the answer he gave right there. It shut him down because there's nothing wrong with it. You may not be able to find it word for word in a science textbook, but don't worry about it. I'm not telling you anything that is untrue. And the reason for that is energy is not created nor destroyed is probably how you heard it. Or the conservation of energy, sometimes it's referred to that. There's several ways. It depends on who's writing the book. You get 10 guys, you could have 10 different ways of writing it. They're all saying the same thing. I'm not saying anything that's incorrect. And you can just remember that response. So tell me what's wrong with it. They won't be able to tell you anything's wrong. Energy cannot be created, first law of thermodynamics, by natural means is where they're tripping up. And the reason for that is because that automatically ascribes to the science that we're dealing with. What that means is we're dealing with empirical evidence. We're dealing with the physical world. There isn't anything but the physical, natural world. Science is not testing the spiritual world. So what's wrong with just pointing it out? By natural means. Because here's what they're going to say. A tricky philosopher is going to do this. And this is why I added it. Well, first law of thermodynamics says energy can't be created, therefore God can't create. So see, I'm helping you here, anticipating the rebuttals. So by stating it like this, you just took that rebuttal out. You're not wasting your time. All right? So those are little subtleties that come into play. I mean, they're not being honest. The fact is they're just not being honest. I can't even have a decent debate with these guys because they're nitpicking every little word and every period and comma and everything else. You can't reason with these people. They're not there to reason. They're just there to harass. So if you can anticipate these things, and hopefully this will help you. Now, everything in the universe is energy. Right? The light is energy. Your hearing sound is energy. Heat is energy. The pews are energy. Your body is energy. The air molecules are energy. There isn't anything that exists that is not a form of energy. Everything's a form of energy. What does the first law of thermodynamics say? Energy cannot create itself. You're probably beginning to recognize what that means. If energy can't create itself, but everything's energy, well, where did this stuff come from then? 3-point argument, guys. Now, who here cannot say that? You just saw it, didn't you? Can it get any easier than that? So the first law, a law of science for which there are no known exceptions and they irrefutable, says energy cannot create itself, and we look around and everything exists as a form of energy. If it didn't create itself naturally, then it must have been created supernaturally. It's just that simple. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have a rebuttal. There's always an answer. There's always a rebuttal. It doesn't even have to be rational. I mean, they're going to have an answer, okay? Because they don't want to let you have the last word. And so sometimes you hear some of the most idiotic things come out of their mouths. For example, when I was dealing with probabilities during one lecture, I had a guy come up to me and say, the probabilities are meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. And I said, oh, why is that? And he said, because it, regardless of the probability statistic, it only had to happen once. I said, well, how do you know it happened? Because we're here. So I said, well, I happen to know that God created us here, created us. He said, how do you know? I said, because we're here. What stupidity. And he's looking at me like, what kind of answer is that? Yeah, well, that's the kind of answer you gave me. One stupid answer deserves another stupid answer. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. These guys can't see the idiocy of their answers because they're so consumed in the right that they're right. That's part of blindness, and they're not thinking clearly. And so we can help them think through this process. But this is a very simple argument. Well, here's what they're going to say. Well, I shouldn't leave this out. Hey, if it was created supernaturally, well, there must be a God out there who did it. All right, now, here's an objection. The humanist might say, well, there is as of yet an undiscovered law, as one mechanical engineer said. There is as of yet some undiscovered law. Or as Dr. Harder, particle physicist up at the university, he heckled one out one time I was lecturing. He said, laws are meant to be broken. Break the first law of thermodynamics. I said, that's fine. That's fine. There, I don't have a problem with that. That's what science is all about, trying to prove things wrong. That's fine. But until that day, this law is the truth. And if you're going to offer a credible, plausible explanation for how things got here, it can't be that energy created itself, because that contradicts the known laws that are known today, not what you hope to find out tomorrow. If you want to kind of use that kind of reasoning, you can believe every Mother Goose story that's been written out there, because who knows, tomorrow you might find out there it was true after all. That's ridiculous. So we have to be confined to the laws that exist today that we know. And then supernatural origin is unscientific. Well, what they're saying there is, well, you can't put God in the test tube type idea, like I mentioned already. That is a comeback that they want to dismiss the empirical evidence and say, well, you just can't entertain God as or the supernatural as an explanation. But look, in science, we operate by ruling out explanations, and we've ruled out the physical and natural explanation. What are we left with? We are left with a logical conclusion that if it wasn't natural, it must have been supernatural. There's nothing irrational about that. And as I mentioned here, the presumptions of atheism and naturalism, it dominates. It controls the thought process in science today. The presumption of atheism is what it's called. Presumption, is that based on anything? Nope, it's a presumption. Yeah, that's right. And so there they are presuming. It's like an axiom. You don't have any evidence for it. It's a starting place. It's their presupposition. Well, who said that's right? There's absolutely no evidence for it whatsoever. All right, so energy was created by natural means is what they claim. Hey, that's contradicting a law of science, and explanations that contradict law of science, laws of science are clearly irrational and unscientific. So the whole idea that energy created itself is unscientific. You can use that, can't you? That's not too hard to say or understand. All right, now here's what they're going to say then. Well, energy didn't create itself. It always existed. Now what are you going to do? Second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says that usable energy cannot be increased in a closed system by natural means. That might sound a little like a mouthful to you, but it's a lot better than saying entropy cannot be increased in a closed system. Or entropy is not reduced in a closed system. Entropy is another word for chaos or disorder or disorganization. And in a closed system refers to a system that you can't enter into and affect. So if I have a box here with a clock in it and nobody can get into it, it's a impenetrable box. And there's a clock inside and nobody can get to it. And we look in there and we see something rather odd. The clock is ticking in a closed system. Nobody can get in there to wind it up, but it's ticking. Now, what question comes to your mind? How did somebody get in there and wind that thing up in the first place? I mean, you can't get into it. It's a closed system. And eventually you know something about that clock as it's ticking. Eventually it's tick, 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 and what? Talk. It's going to stop. That's called entropy. Everything is heading towards an end point. Everything's going to stop. The universe, it's called universal heat death. The entire universe is heading in the direction towards heat death. Heat being the ultimate and maximized entropy, form of entropy. Everything is headed in that direction, which means that energy cannot organize itself. First law of thermodynamics says energy cannot create itself. Second law of thermodynamics says it cannot organize itself. Organization is the opposite of entropy. Energy cannot organize itself. In other words, it can't wind itself up. Now, if the clock is ticking, what does that tell you? It's been wound up. The second law of thermodynamics is what it comes down to is, second law of thermodynamics says the clock can't wind itself up. We are looking at the universe right now. And the universe is like a gigantic clock that's ticking. And it's winding down. Now wait, a ticking clock winding down means that somewhere in the past, it had to get wound up. You can't be unwinding unless you were wound up in the first place. The second law of thermodynamics says it didn't wind itself up. If it didn't wind itself up naturally, it must have happened supernaturally. I hope you feel a little more confident now. And I can use that. I can make that point, that argument. So the first and second laws of thermodynamics, the bottom line is energy cannot create or organize itself by natural means. And yet everything exists as organized energy. If it didn't happen by natural means, then it must have happened supernaturally. That's right. And it happened supernaturally, then, man, there must be a God. Now what we're doing, and you probably see the significance of this, but what we're doing is we're establishing the answers to the first two fundamental questions. That is forcing, it's ruling out the explanation of a natural world without God. It's ruling it out. It's forcing us to conclude, oh, there must be a God. Or as the geneticist said, to me as we went around and around on this issue over and over again for about 2 hours in a parking lot after a seminar. He finally said, "Man, I see what you mean. I can't accept it, but I see what you mean." You see, it's just that clear. Well, I say it's that clear. It took 2 hours to get to that point where he finally said, "I see what you're saying." All right. That's something you can take with you. Be patient. I had an ongoing debate with a geologist from the university and a hobbyist anthropologist, a medical doctor up in Springdale, and an engineer from the mechanical engineering department, and then a science teacher. And they were evolutionists, and I gave them, we met for 2.5 years every other month. And I would give them all my, here, I wanted to put all my stuff to the test. And so I give it to them, and then we'd meet, and then they would debate and rebut me. And so what I'm sharing with you has been put through the fire. And I got to hear their responses. So, and I needed that for myself. But as I was going through this with them, it became obvious that to Dr. Cherry that what I was saying, when it took 2.5 years, he finally came to the point of understanding what I was saying. And that in that last meeting, he put the chalk down on the chalkboard and said, "I agree." I'm just telling you, be patient. It took 2.5 years. And he's no dummy. He's a smart man. But took 2.5 years. And he's the guy, and we're friends, and he said, "Whenever you're talking on the subject of creation, you let me know, whether it be a Bible study, a seminar, or wherever you are, I want to be there." And so I did. I let him know, and he was always there for 2.5 years. That's how long it took. I attribute that to the blindness that Satan pulls over people's eyes and plugs their ears with. Even though they hear it, they got to hear it again and again and again. The Lord has to work in their heart. And there's a lot of rinsing going out. Satan is designing this world to blind the hearts and minds of them, lest they should hear the light of the glorious gospel. And we got to be patient. Just share it and share it again and share again. Answer their rebuttals and their objections and pray for them. So what they might say is, "Well, the initial usable energy originated naturally anyway." Now wait, you can't say that. You just what you're offering is unscientific. Yeah, but you can't include God in the explanation. That's violates, they're not going to say violates the presumption of atheism. What they're going to say is, you just can't, God cannot be included as an answer. Now during the evolution class that I was required to take in my last 6 months of my last semester of graduate work, we went around on this subject, and I challenged Dr. Carr, and I said, "Dr. Carr, you know, I am more objective and able as a creationist with advantage to be a clear-thinking, honest scientist." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because I can be open to entertain any idea and any explanation. But what you have done is put blinders on yourself, and you said, it can't be this answer, it can only be this answer. So whatever you see has to be forced into your already presumed conclusion, your presumption. And it doesn't matter what the evidence says, it has to be explained in a natural way. You are forcing it. That's bias. That's unclear thinking. That's unscientific. A scientist must be open to allow the evidence to lead him to a conclusion, not to force a conclusion. And that's how we want to approach this. Well, one more law. You need that. Now, let me point this out. The first two laws, first law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, these two laws argue for the case and are evidence for the origin of the universe, origin of energy. had nothing to do with law, with life, okay? Nothing to do with life. It's all about the origin of the universe. Now I'm going to give you evidence from life. And that is the law of biogenesis. Now I might point out, there are evolutionists and they're going to be devious, and some of them have just been duped themselves. They're going to say, well, the law of biogenesis doesn't say that. Where does that exist? This law is being censored out of the books. I discovered that during a seminar I was doing. A zoology professor was there who sat on the book committee at the University of Arkansas and approved the books being used in biology. And I had put up a definition for the law of biogenesis. All cells come from pre-existing cells. And I took that quote right out of the book, the textbook that she sat on the committee that approved for use in the university biology class. Do you see the contradiction she was faced with there? Well, she had approved the book. This was the Helena Curtis textbook called Biology on page 92. I know the reference and I refer to it because that book disappeared after that seminar. Not only did it disappear out of the classroom, never been used again for biology at the University of Arkansas, it was taken off the shelves in the library. Remember we talked about censorship and worldview warfare? They want to control information. You control information, you control ideas. And so what they did was they censored this law. Now, that doesn't make the law go away. It just means it's more difficult to find. People don't know what this law is, haven't seen it before. Now, all cells come from pre-existing cells. That was a law that was established by Louis Pasteur's famous experiment, the swan neck. Now, he didn't coin the phrase. Another scientist did after him. But he was the one who put to rest spontaneous generation theory and demonstrated that all living cells must come from pre-existing cells. That is irrefutable to this day. There are no known exceptions. There's no reason to think it will ever be otherwise, regardless of whether or not they print it. Well, all attempts to create life from lifeless molecules have failed. 100%. Oh, hey, there's a lot of energy being spent to do it. In fact, I'll tell you, Dr. Jack Zostak over in Harvard, he's been working on it since the 80s. In fact, 1992, there was an article. It was a short, obscure article in our local newspaper, and it said, "Life created in the laboratory." I said, "What?" And so I'm reading this thing, and sure enough, Zostak is claiming that he created life in the laboratory. Well, the whole article, 99% of the article was redefining what life was so it could conform to what he did in the laboratory. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, and what he did was he took some bubbles, what are called micelles, and he took some bubbles and he put some proteins in there and some other nutrients that you would find in life. And sure enough, they migrated inside the bubbles, the cells, and he had all the conditions for life. He demonstrated that all the molecules needed to put themselves together for life happened right there in the laboratory. And they went one step further. They reproduced. But as you read further, you find out how they were reproducing. He was shaking the flask, and the bubbles divided. Yeah. I mean, yeah, what kind of science is that? Harvard scientist creates life in the laboratory that can reproduce. Shake the flask. Now, think about this. I got to thinking about this, and I thought, you know, how many people wash dishes every night and create life in the sink? You got the bubbles. Yeah. You got the bubbles, you got the fats, the proteins, the carbohydrates, the nucleic acids, everything there. You scrape all the scrapings from food. They migrate in the bubbles, and then you put your hands in there, and they're dividing and multiplying. That's exactly what's going on. Now, how many have heard of Jack Zostak? That's because he never did create life in the laboratory. He's still working on it. He went from 7 steps to 12 steps. Now he's only 2 steps away from creating life in the laboratory. Yeah, well, he created in 1992 and said by the end of the year, it'll be reproducing on its own. Well, that was 1992. Still hasn't happened. The law of biogenesis says that life, all living cells come from pre-existing living cells. If life did not come into being by itself, by natural means, from lifeless molecules, and yet they exist, then that tells us, well, it must have been supernatural, which means there must be a God. That seems simple enough. Now, I just gave you 3 laws of science to demonstrate and support the correct answer for, yes, there's more than a physical world and that there is a God. Hey, we're on our way to establishing the biblical worldview. Now, I'm going to introduce something else, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this so that you're not too overwhelmed. I don't know, maybe some of you understand that. Strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, gravitational force, electromagnetic force. You know what these represent? 4 fundamental forces that explain everything in the world. 4 fundamental forces. Hey, that sounds like 4 fundamental questions, doesn't it? That just sort of happened that way. But there's 4 fundamental forces that explain the behavior of all matter in the world. Strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, gravitational force. Now, if you were to alter the strong nuclear force by the slightest degree, just a 1% difference, slightly stronger, slightly weaker, then the atoms, the protons in the atoms would fly apart or they'd be so stuck together there wouldn't be any individual atoms. Same way with weak nuclear force, same thing. Same thing with gravitational force. Now, let me ask you this. If the existence of all things were invented and came into being at the Big Bang explosion by itself, naturally, nothing exploded into everything that exists, contrary and in contradiction to the laws of thermodynamics. But that's where everything came from. You know what was invented at the same time? The 4 fundamental forces. Why is gravitational force as strong as it is or as weak as it is? If it was just a little stronger, everything would collapse. If it was a little weaker, everything would fly apart. What about a strong nuclear force? Why is it that force? A little weaker, a little stronger, the world would not exist. Weak force, same thing. The world could not exist. Electromagnetic force, same thing. Nothing could exist except that they all occur at that particular strength. What is the probability that that strong nuclear force is the strength it is? Well, to figure out the probability, you have to know what the opportunities are. How many possibilities? Infinite. What? Well, nothing exploding into everything. I mean, anything's up for grabs. I mean, it could go anywhere. It could be any strength, any weakness. It's 1 in 2 infinity chances that it would be there. 1 in infinity chances that it would be that? Yep. And not only that, but the weak nuclear force. 1 in infinity that it's that force. Gravitational force, 1 to infinity that force. 1 in 2 infinity, electromagnetic force, that force. Do you see how absolutely absurd and improbable that could happen all by itself, by accident? So Richard Dawkins, one of the belligerent neo-atheist evolutionists out there in the world, promoting atheism, he says, well, we don't know exactly how it all came to be, but we know it did. Because we're here talking about it. That's the best they got. Because we're here talking about it. You see, it's so improbable that the conditions for existence with the four fundamental forces would be not just one of them, but all four of them, and there's a whole lot more things, fine-tuned. It's so improbable, so absurdly impossible that all those things would come together so that we could have a world that exists. It had to happen here by the very fact that we exist. So they proposed then the bubbling universes. We are one in infinite numbers of universes floating around, and universes are springing up and popping out and bubbling up over and over and over again to infinity. That's how they overcome improbability. Well, now you know it. And you can say that's absolutely absurd. I had a atheist philosopher challenge me on that. Say that to me. I said, now tell me, what is the evidence that there are more universes than the one we have? Oh, well, there's scientists are saying this. I said, no, I don't want to know what scientists are saying. I want to know, what is the evidence? Well, there's a lot of good evidence out there. I said, well, tell me what the evidence is. Oh, so-and-so believes this. I said, I don't care what so-and-so believes. I want to know what the evidence is. You press that point. We can't even see the edge of our own universe, much less outside the universe, to know that there's anything outside our universe. You see, that's absolutely ridiculous. They are making it up, guys. They're making it up. How do you know there's bubbling universes, more than one universe? Nobody has a clue. How do you, and here's something else to consider. We talked about one in infinity, that the strength of a force would be that. But why four? Why not five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 30, 40, 50, 60, blah, 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 right to infinity? Why not just one? Why did it happen to be those four at those strengths, one in infinity for every one of those possible combinations, and here we are? It happened all by accident. This is called the fine-tune argument. I think you can grasp that and share that too. All right, we'll wrap this up. There's the Intelligent Design Evolution Awareness Center. They say there's an abundant wealth of evidence from the workings of physics, chemistry, and properties of the universe, our solar system, and the Earth, which indicate that life on Earth did not happen by accident. It was planned. These arguments are typically called anthropic principles, where physical properties or parameters seem to be just right or fine-tuned to allow for life, and not necessarily just for life as we know it. In other words, the fine-tuned argument, we should not be here. It defies all probabilities. Brother Bob, I need you to advance that. Next slide. If we could play God, this is Paul Davies, and I haven't confirmed this, but I used to read him when he was an atheist. He's not an atheist anymore. Same way with Anthony Flew, by the way, who is an atheist, a philosopher, British philosopher for 60 some years. He was a leading atheist philosopher. And just the last couple years of his life, he announced to the world there must be a first cause. Now, when a hardcore atheist says there must be a first cause and a God, that you want to find out why. And so I checked out his testimony. He's got interviews, and he wrote about it. And what he said was it was all because of the law of biogenesis. He said, I've been studying and looking at this for 20 years. There's no way life is going to pop into existence and defy all the probabilities of existence. So we've got the evidence on our side, and Paul Davies is convinced, or convinced him, the fine-tuned argument. And Fred Hoyle, an astronomer, says there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Too bad that doesn't, that's not true for others as well, because we need more scientists to be honest and get out of their out of the blindness of their presumption. So we have answered a question with three evidences. First law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, and the law of biogenesis. Now, here's a very interesting thought process, exercise, philosophy, because it is possible for an evolutionist to say, well, you have, or an atheist, you have not, you've demonstrated that there's supernatural, but what connects the supernatural to God? All right? So if you run across this, and we'll end with this. If you run across that argument, then here's what you say. Well, consider that energy, as you say, has always existed. We notice in our world incredible complexity that is unmatched, of immense and enormous size, with a complexity that requires an infinite mind to design, and if it's intelligent, then it must have a personality. And a personality that has fine-tuned the universe to sustain life, which suggests compassion. What do you call a supernatural entity that always existed, is complex, immense in size, has infinite intelligence, personal, has personality, and is caring and compassionate? Sounds like God. All worldviews that deny the existence of God, then, and deny that there's a physical world, are false. We just knocked out the worldviews that all deny God and deny that there's more than a physical world. So we knocked off two questions there out of our four fundamental questions. The empirical evidence for God justifies a search, then, to determine which God. All right, so that seemed rather simple, doesn't it? I hope it did to you. First law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, and the law of biogenesis. You are armed and equipped to answer those two fundamental questions. Now you say, what about the next two? Well, here's what I do in my seminar series, such as this. Those are answers that have already been answered and dealt with quite sufficiently, quite a bit. And Brother Hudson and others here know these arguments for Jesus Christ. And the argument that I use for Jesus Christ being God is the same evidence he said. Destroy this temple and I'll raise it up, which verifies everything that I said to be true. The citadel information or evidence of all the claims of Christ is God. Well, what's the best evidence for his resurrection? That's what we're looking for, because that's the evidence he said we ought to look for, right? Well, martyrdom is the best evidence we've got, because here you have 11 of the apostles, and Judas had already hung himself, 11 of the apostles who were supposedly, by the atheists or by the skeptics, claiming that, well, they went out and stole the body away. That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Why? These guys paid a big price for that lie, if it was a lie. They were willing to suffer torture and death for a lie. Now, most people are willing to lie, cheat, and steal, and do whatever they can to avoid pain and torture, and certainly death. What do they have to gain out of being killed and tortured? Absolutely nothing. If they knew where the body was and they were the perpetrators of hiding the body, they would be absolutely insane. As one person said, well, yeah, there are insane people. I say, okay, I'll give you one, but 11? They said, yeah, but people are killing themselves all the time today. The Muslims are doing that. I said, well, that's not the same. They have been duped into believing a lie. These guys were the perpetrators. And if they're the perpetrators, they would have known where the body is, what body was. Why would they throw their lives away for a lie? It makes absolutely no sense. Martyrdom is the very best evidence we've got for the claims of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Which then, if he's raised, then he is God and all everything he said is true. And that plays right into then revelation of the Bible, inspiration of the Bible. But you see, my part, my contribution is to let you know, here's how you can argue the case to the secularists that, yes, indeed, there is more than a physical world and there is a God. And you're off and running, and then you've got the book of authority to determine all the other answers. Amen? Thank you very much.